Hello, everyone. I'm Becca, dietitian by trade, mom 24/7, wife from the start, and when there's a few extra hours in the day, you might find me hitting the trails or on horseback.
And I'm Kara, a therapist to women, a mom to a boy, an entrepreneur, mountain junkie, and a postpartum runner.
And this is Fit for a Queen, a podcast that's devoted to the female athlete wanting to balance the teeter-totter of all the things we desire out of life as women. Performance, health, intellect, and taking time for self, even if we only get 1 minute out of the day.
We're so excited to be bringing you the queens in the athletic world who have done just that. Okay, ladies, take a seat at your thrones, grab your crowns, and welcome to Fit for a Queen.
Well, welcome, queens. We have Dr. Stacy Hunt here today. She is a clinical psychologist, co-director of Buck Support Service, as well as Newton Therapy and Wellness Center. She holds a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Virginia, and she earned her bachelor's degree from New York University with a master's in clinical psychology from University of Virginia, as well as California State University at Dominguez Hills. Dr. Hunt is a member of the Honor Society, hopefully I said that right, in psychology, American Psychological Association, Pennsylvania Psychological Association, and the Behavioral Genetics Association, which I loved reading about that. That's really fascinating. That's an area of your interest. She currently serves on the board for the Greater Philadelphia Chapter of the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals, and several of her academic research papers have been published in peer-reviewed professional journals on various developmental topics.
In addition to her work with patients suffering from mood and anxiety disorders, Dr. Hunt specializes in eating disorders, substance abuse, ADHD, sport, and performance psychology, as well as working with people in the LGBTQI community. She's trained in dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic psychotherapy, solution-focused therapy, ego psychology, interpersonal therapy, and relational therapy. Dr. Hunt believes in finding the style of therapy that will most powerfully affect change for each individual while building on the client's own strengths and resources. Dr. Hunt did her doctoral internship at Ewing Residential Treatment Center and the Department of Children and Families in New Jersey. She did her postdoc internship at both Pendle Mental Health Center and at TLC Associates in Newton, Pennsylvania. Dr. Hunt also is trained at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the Adolescent HIV Initiative and in the Neuropsychology Department at the Culpeper Juvenile Correctional Center in the Behavioral Sciences Unit and at the Mary D. Answorth Psychological Clinic at the University of Virginia. Welcome, Dr. Hunt.
Wow. Thank you. It always sounds interesting to hear your own background read back to you. Oh, okay.
Well, thank you for having me. Very thorough. You've got a great background. So,
yeah. A lot of intricacies within your work. So that's why we're really excited to interview you today. And one of the first questions I was really wanting to know was, how did you get into this area of focusing on eating disorders and addictions?
Well, you know, with that particular question, I have to go back to my own personal history, which is not on, you know, a person's vita or resume. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, has to do with primarily beginning as a very precocious adolescent teenager, getting involved in ballet, gymnastics. I was at School of American Ballet doing, you know, while in high school. And the pressures that sort of mounted for me with that experience led me down a path of not only being eating disorders, but participating in them, substance use that was really quite prevalent at that time in my life. So having then had a personal journey, which involved recovery, and I'm 25 years sober now, and a recovery from disordered eating, I really felt like this was something that I needed to venture into in my professional life.
Well, yeah, it's always helped when you have that personal tie-in because you feel that connection. So it's such an area that's been understudied, but glad that people like you are bringing attention to it. The other part that I was really fascinated by is your work at looking at genetics. And I think we're just on the cusp of using that for preventative. So can you tell us how you believe that plays a role in the development of addictions and eating disorders and where you stand on this currently?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so my own research when I was doing my doctoral dissertation at University of Virginia was really focused on the behavior genetics piece. And that was the lab I was in, and I was sort of trained to do stats and modeling that was around not only twin studies, but children of twin studies. So it gave us this amazing ability to hold certain things constant and to look at, you know, what piece is genetic, which is the heritable piece of different disorders. And it is really fascinating to try to understand some of that. It's clearly not an exact science. I think even from one study to another, you'll see, you know, one study might find that something's more heritable than in another study. But there are some general trends, for sure. I would say in the eating disorder community, twin studies have pointed to somewhere around 50% as the heritability of eating disorders. And of course, it's and some even as high as 62% is heritable. And part of the variability there is around the different kinds of eating disorders. So there's bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder. So, you know, there's variance in there. So they've even kind of honed it in further to show that there's personality traits that seem to predispose a person for an eating disorder. So when you say somebody, let's say a disorder has a 50% loading in heritability, it basically means that 50% of the gun is sort of loaded and that the environment may pull the trigger. That's how I kind of view it. And then to make it even more complicated, if you want to wrap your brain around it, there's the sort of genetics by environment interaction. So you might have somebody who's predisposed, but they're in an environment that doesn't really influence them in that way. And the gun's never, you know, it's never pulled. But an environment where, let's say, somebody predisposed to an eating disorder is around, you know, in a family where there's a lot of attention paid to appearance or, you know, how much weight they've lost, or maybe a parent is very, you know, involved in that kind of behavior, you're more likely to pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. So that's the eating disorder piece. Substance abuse also ranges quite a bit, but I think there we have a little bit more precision in some of the studies. The NIH had a nice study in 2012, and it can be anywhere from 40% heritable in hallucinogens up to 72% around drugs like cocaine. Wow. Yeah,
72%. That's pretty high.
Pretty well loaded. So, you know, taking that into account, when you're looking at working with someone, it helps to know some of this was how they were sort of pre-wired, predisposed. So that's the behavior. I would say that's the summary of how the behavior genetics piece influences where I stand on eating disorders, addiction. And that's just in the general population. So then we haven't really done any behavior genetic studies around athletes, as far as I know. I hope someday, you know, that'll be out there too. But we know that athletes have, you know, it's about 13% prevalence for eating disorders in general. The general population is more like 4.5%. And then if you look at athletes who are involved in the aesthetic sports, you know, gymnastics, cheerleading, dance, it's at 42% is really the estimated rate of eating disorders.
That's
crazy. Pretty prevalent.
I wonder what those numbers, if it helps to kind of decrease some of the shame around it when they can hear like 75% likelihood that you could with these, you know, I don't know if you're looking at SNPs or something, but make you prone to cocaine use if they're like, oh, okay. Wasn't a personal choice.
Right. And then it can also help to educate, you know, children and young adults to even say, look, in our family, this runs in the family. Let's be really mindful. Let's help educate you. And of course, if parents are not participating in drugs and alcohol, that can help. That can be a positive influence. Sometimes you look at people who go down that path and you look at the family and go, what? How did, you know, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And that's when you really have to think about the other factors that are at play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, talking a little bit about substance abuse, we haven't talked about it yet on the podcast, and I think it's getting touched on a little bit more, but I feel that substance abuse and kind of active or athlete population can be overlooked because this population is deemed as healthy or more healthy or have healthy coping skills. But can you tell us a little bit about this population being at risk or individuals within this population?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, you know, there are some athletes who may never go down the path of, you know, substance use. And I certainly work with those people as well. But in general, from what I'm seeing among athletes is that they have an enormous pressure, especially those that are, and I work mostly with teens, young adults, college age students, enormous pressure to do well, perform well. Maybe they're trying to get into a college. Maybe they're trying to keep their, you know, their grant or whatever it is that's keeping them in school. And the general pressures of the people around them, you know, that place on them to perform well. So beginning with that pressure, looking at that they're probably already high achievers, so they're likely to have perfectionistic qualities. They really want to appear healthy, and sometimes folks who want to appear healthy might do maladaptive things to have that look and to perform well. So once the drive to perform well and appear a certain way kind of rises above the intrinsic desire to be healthy, we're in a danger zone, because then the person feels like I need to get to that no matter what it takes. And I think those people are really prone to performance enhancing drugs and to sort of use stimulants, steroids, to sort of push themselves to the next level. And that's kind of one category of the substance use risk. And then the other, you know, is more along the lines of what typical teens and college students are at risk for, which is, you know, drinking, binge drinking, pot use, a lot of cannabis. And athletes, you know, are just as at risk, if not higher, for the binge eating. And in college students, it's a higher risk. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, they tend to smoke cigarettes less, and illegal drugs, there's a lower rate for that behavior. But those first two categories are really where the danger is, especially with tremendous anxiety. Well, you know, a joint can kind of make that feel better when you're sure. feeling that kind of enormous pressure. So it's very understandable to look for self-medicating to get through these periods. But certainly in the long run, is very harmful for these athletes.
Great point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking a lot about the systems approach too, of all the pressure on adolescents and college athletes during this day of age, and what mm-hmm. services and help can improve to help some of those students. So those are very mm-hmm. good points. It's different pressures these days than definitely when I grew up, or things change so quickly in this day and age.
Yeah. You know, to sort of piggyback on that, I was talking to a dancer about, you know, how she looks at Instagram and social media. Mm-hmm. And she looks at all these pictures, and there's even Pro Anna websites that sort of promote this look that's so unhealthy. And it just, I was just sort of thinking that when I was dancing, it was bad enough, but we didn't have these images coming at us,
right.
you know, 24 hours a day. If anything, I remember staring at, you know, the Gelsey Kirkland Dancing on My Grave book and the pictures in there. And I can remember them in my mind. There was probably six of them. And that was it. You know, where else was I going to get images of somebody who looked really ill? I have to keep going back to that same book. Now, I mean, it's become just absorbing, and it sort of comes at them as well. Even when they turn off this and they stop following that person, another one will kind of come up in their stream, and oh, maybe I'll click and like that. And then you got a new person that's got a blog that you're following, or Twitter feed, or whatever.
That is so true. Like Teen Vogue. I can't even remember what magazines would have been popular when I was younger, but nobody would wear like these skimpy dress outfits that you see now, and you'd have to sneak it while you're at Walmart real quick looking through, and then before your mom's like, come on, let's go.
Right. That's all you got. Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's really hard to avoid now with, all of those apps and accesses. So that's a really good kind of segue to my next question of social media being an influence. But what are some other themes that you're noticing in the area of eating disorders, substance abuse in athletes, or new research or issues that you're seeing in clinical practice?
I think one of the pieces I would say that I think is pretty dangerous right now is what started off as sort of a healthy idea of clean eating and sort of eating well and even being athletic, that has kind of morphed into its own disorder, sort of an orthorexia, an idea of kind of having that it's obsessive in its behavior, and it's sort of this obsessive pursuit of a healthy diet, but it ends up really trending towards the same kind of obsessive controlling issues that we have with patients who are anorexic. And oftentimes it sort of bleeds right over into it. So for me, I think that becomes the real challenge, especially with athletes, to sort of honor where they're at, what they're looking to achieve, to honor that they're going to exercise more than the average individual. And I don't have to jump to the idea that it's exercise addiction, to kind of see the person for their entire self, and then address whether they are being too restrictive in one area or another, and whether they need to sort of allow themselves to be human, to eat something yummy every now and then, to follow those intuitive eating cues of hunger and fullness, and not feel like they need to keep themselves bound in that way. So for me, I feel like even the sort of societal ed eating disorder can really harm athletes, because they then trend towards that obsessive style as well.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I like that. Mm-hmm. Societal ed disorder.
That's really good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Stacey, we always, or Dr. Hunt, like to end each session going over the FIT philosophy and how you live that out. So how do you balance performance, health, intellect, and taking that time for self?
That's
we seem to get that response a lot.
Yeah, I know. That is a good question. It's interesting. First of all, I like to really caution myself and others against excessive moderation, because when I try to balance too hard, I find that I end up in another area of problem where I'm dissatisfied with myself because I haven't balanced well enough. But I think in general, you know, my life has sort of guided me toward needing these certain things. And I love the idea of performance, health, intellect, and time for self. I think that just kind of captures it. The time for self piece, I think, is where that could be defined in so many ways. And for me, it could be getting a massage. It could be hanging with my kids. I have 5 kids, so they need time. That's, you know, time for self. That could be, and that's where the balance gets a little tricky there, because I want to have time for family, but I also need time alone. I need time with my husband. I need time with my friends. I was really fortunate when I built my space that I work in now, our wellness center, that my partner, Catherine Shipley, and I decided to add a yoga studio into the building. It's just amazing.
Nice.
I mean, I have to say, today I had a 40-minute meditation and I had a 45-minute circuit training with, you know, our trainer. And tomorrow I'll have yoga at noon. And so we've found this way to just have like a 45-minute, 1-hour something several times a week that really helped me feel very balanced. I think that's probably the most important one for me. I need that, like I need air. And then, you know, keeping myself cognitively, intellectually inspired. I'm doing a sports psychology certification right now, because I'm just so jazzed about how that, you know, is kind of resonating with me. So following some of that and keeping the mind fresh, I think, is just so important. But I look at it more like the balance over maybe like a longer period of time, let's say 2 weeks, you know, have I gotten some of this in there and some of that in there? If I try to do it all in one day, I'm likely to feel like I'm driving myself, you know, nuts. Yeah. So if I can pan out a little bit and just make sure, you know, the scale isn't tipped too hard in one direction or the other. And sometimes letting it tip, you know, if you're preparing for something and you need to put all that energy into work, well, let it go there for a little while. It'll come back,
yeah,
you know,
I
and
like
then
that.
Yeah, sometimes you got to tip it and we're just doing maintenance on, you know, athletics. And other times it's, you know what, I'm going to go for that triathlon again. It sort of, it moves around and you got to let yourself be a little bit forgiving of the tipping as it happens, I would say.
That's true. It's like a teeter totter. It never is actually in perfect balance, right? It's always teetering.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Hunt, you should definitely put mother of five in your bio because that is quite the accomplishment for sure.
Yeah,
so, wow. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Hunt.
Thank you. This was really fun to give some thought to some of the things that we're all focused on. And I know you guys are doing your work in the same area. So the more we know, you know, the better we can provide.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you have a great rest of your week, and hopefully you get some nice quiet time to yourself before going home.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks so much.
Bye, Queens.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you to our sponsor today, Sentimano Counseling. Sentimano Counseling is the premier perinatal mental health practice in Kansas City, treating mood disorders during pregnancy and postpartum, perinatal loss, infertility, eating, and exercise disorders. Go to sentimano.com for further information about the practice and services. For additional information on today's topic and guests, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FitForAQueen. And
hashtag fit for a queen.
And don't forget to rate us on iTunes. We can't wait for you to join us next time on Fit for a Queen.
Bye, queens.